Hey, everybody. Our show is part of WNYC, which is New York's public radio station. And one role the station has always played is to offer a place for sort of a public convening in big moments, a place to come together, process what's happening, and what it all means. So when the news of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death hit, the United States of Anxiety stepped into that role for 2 hours on Sunday evening. We're sharing both hours here separately. And this one, we focus on RBG's life. Check out the other hour for our best effort to figure out whatever is coming next at the Supreme Court. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
The duty of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg does not need a seat on the Supreme Court to earn a place in our history books. She has already secured that.
The point is that the discriminatory line almost inevitably hurts women.
I call her the steel magnolia. Delicate on the outside, but she has an iron rod behind her.
This is something central to a woman's life. It's a decision that she must make for herself.
A strong conservative majority, now within sight on the Supreme Court, will help shape America for decades to come.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, born in Flatbush, Brooklyn in 1933, a first-generation daughter of Russian Jewish immigrants, has passed on to glory. She was a towering figure in the history of the United States for her legal career and also as a role model of leadership for women in particular, but for all of us, certainly me, all of us who wish to be free of the tyranny of gender stereotypes and inequality. Justice Ginsburg identified herself as, quote, a woman, a mother, and a Jew, all structural disadvantages to her as she tried to make a life and a career in law. Of course, we would ultimately attach many superlatives to those identities. The second woman to serve on the Supreme Court, the longest-serving Jewish justice, a trailblazing academic career, a history-changing litigator, and one of the very few octogenarians to ever become a pop culture icon. Mourners have been gathering on the steps of the Supreme Court since minutes after the news broke on Friday night, people ranging from sitting senators to passersby, children with their parents, law school students, just all manner of people for whom Justice Ginsburg's life set an example of how to contribute. One Howard University student told the Washington Post, she said, quote, I'm just really thankful to have been alive while she was. I feel the same way. This evening, we're gathering for a special two-hour edition of the United States of Anxiety to talk about Justice Ginsburg's life and her career. Later in the show, we'll dive into all the gritty details of the court, what her death means both right now and into the future. But for this first hour, we're going to set aside all the politics of the moment and just try to appreciate what this unique human being brought to the world. And I'm joined by Emily Bazelon, who is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest, as we take your calls. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, you know, we're asking our callers this question, Emily, about Justice Ginsburg's leadership and what inspired them. So I guess I want to start with that with you. What about you in your long career with the law? How has Justice Ginsburg shown up for you personally?
So I met Justice Ginsburg for the first time in 2008 through my grandmother, which I know is sort of unlikely, but Justice Ginsburg in the 1990s served on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals with my grandfather, and who then died. But she lived in the same apartment building, the Watergate, as my grandparents. And my grandmother knew her mostly because they shared a tailor. She was wearing something one day, and Justice Ginsburg asked her who had made it. And that was how they connected over the years. And so I interviewed Justice Ginsburg a few times, and the first time was in 2009 for the New York Times Magazine. I was super nervous. I brought three tape recorders. I turned them all on. And I tried really hard to remember to wait and not interrupt her. That was like my big terror, because Justice Ginsburg was known for pausing between sentences.
Right.
And I was really afraid I was going to step on her words.
And how did it go? Did you manage to pull it off?
Yeah, it all worked out. I emerged with a tape recording, which worked. And I wrote an article for the Times Magazine. It was really just a Q&A with her. It was this interesting moment for her on the court because Justice Sotomayor's nomination was pending. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Justice Ginsburg had been the only woman on the court for 3 years because Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had retired in 2006. And you could tell that Justice Ginsburg was just very eager to have company again. She saw it as, I think, important for her own experience, but much more centrally, she wanted there to be more women's voice and a greater presence for women at the Supreme Court. That meant a lot to her.
Well, one of the things I hadn't realized that I learned in sort of reading all of the obituaries and biographies now was that, you know, in that time period, she considered it such that she thought that was one of her worst times on the court because she hated walking out as the only woman and, you know, in famously small stature with all of these big men. She thought it looked bad in terms of the message to women. Is that true?
Yes, that's definitely. She was really concerned that people see the court as a place where women had a real seat and a real presence. And, you know, in that interview, I tried to understand. I asked her about research showing that women judges sometimes reach different kinds of results in cases. And she was very skeptical of that. For her, it was not about the idea that women were different. There's nothing essentialist about her argument. She just really wanted equality, like for equality's sake. She, in a lot of ways, was really radical about gender roles for men and women, really for everybody. She just wanted to explode stereotypical expectations of what people could do.
I really want to walk through some of her legal accomplishments and just sort of wrap our heads around what it actually means. But before we get to that, I also, you know, her biography is in and of itself. Her life story is inspiring to so many people. She led, I guess, what feels like a uniquely public life for a justice to me. Is that true? Is sort of the public nature of her life been unique for justices? And if so, what does that mean?
I mean, I think that there is something just really special about her place on the court. And it's lots of people have, you know, kind of unlikely rises. That's true. You know, for example, Justice Scalia, Justice Alito, they also started in relatively humble circumstances. But, you know, because Justice Ginsburg went to law school in the 1950s, when she was only one of 9 women at her class in Harvard, and when the dean took each of those women aside and said, explain to me why you're taking the place of a male potential classmate, like you're in someone's spot. There is just something about that kind of barrier breaking that makes women who pulled that off very determined and steely. And I think that is really special about her.
Right. And I can imagine that if, you know, particularly for women who lived through that time period of trying to step into public life at a time when there were such overt barriers to entering public life. Not that there aren't barriers now, but at a time when they were so overt that her story would be particularly resonant.
Yeah. And, you know, to propel yourself through that, you just have to be so determined to do it. And you believe, and I think this is like the most important thing about what fired Ginsburg's whole career. You believe in your own capabilities. You also believe that other people have capabilities, other women, other people who don't fit into neat boxes. They have capabilities that are being smothered, and that your job as a lawyer, if you are her, is to spring them from that trap. And that really just animated every important case that she litigated and a lot of the opinions she wrote on the court. Mm.
This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and we are reflecting on the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm speaking with New York Times Magazine writer Emily Bazelon, and we are taking your calls. How did Justice Ginsburg's life and leadership inspire you? How'd her work show up in your life? Call us at 646-435-7280. Again, that's 646-435-7280, or tweet us using the hashtag US of Anxiety. And let's talk to Erin Kelly in San Francisco. Welcome to WNYC, Erin.
Hello. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So, Erin, I understand that you have a story about how Justice Ginsburg inspired you. I gather you are a girls' soccer coach, and you and your whole team of 10-year-olds were all sort of at a Halloween soccer tournament dressed up as her, just dressed up as Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Tell us what happened.
Yes. And that's exactly it. The soccer club Girls Unite, it supports girls, and we do it through all-female coaching. So we went to this tournament, and we're all dressed as RBG, and people would come up to us and say, who are you? And we'd say, we're RBG. And they're like, who is that? And it was just wonderful to see all these little girls telling the story, saying, oh, she's the second woman appointed to the Supreme Court justice. She's fighting for women's equality and rights and so forth. And a bunch of little 10-year-old girls who were loving this. So we're at the tournament, we're in the finals, and unfortunately we tied. So the game goes to penalty kicks, which is a terrible way to end soccer. Celebrate misses instead of celebrating making it. And so we have to stand back, and our five girls go up, and there is a coach on the other team standing behind the goal, which is completely illegal, and he's coaching. And I don't notice this until a parent tells me. So all of a sudden, I start walking over. I'm a very tall woman, so I'm walking over, dressed as RBG, my robes are billowing out, and this guy, I walk straight up to him like, what are you doing? And he goes, who are you? And I wanted to say, I'm RBG, your worst nightmare, but I said, I am the coach. And he's like, I'm just a parent. I'm like, you're not allowed to be behind here and telling the girls what they can do. And he's like, I'm not, I'm just a parent. I'm like, really? You're just a parent. He's like, you're the crazy lady dressed up like that. And I swear, at that moment, once he said crazy lady, I swear she was like, inspire me. I looked at him like, please don't talk to me that way. And please show some integrity, but I know you're lying. And he goes, how do you know I'm lying? I'm like, turn around. And on the back of his jersey, it says coach. So everyone is dead silent and they're looking at me. And I just felt at this moment, RBG would be so proud, just keeping my cool, because I don't always keep my cool. She does things. She was kind of a quiet woman, but she did things with grace and dignity, and that is the one thing I'll miss about her. And even today, my daughter remembers. She goes, remember when we were RBG and that guy was lying to you and you're telling him, please don't lie. It's not winning at all costs. Mm. And she's like, you know, that was my favorite soccer tournament, even though we didn't end up winning. And she is that role model, and even though she has passed, she's going to inspire more people to do this, more people to stand up. This is what we need.
That's lovely, Erin. Thank you for that. We're going to have to go to a break soon, so I'm going to let you go. But thank you so much for that charming story. And Emily, that, I guess, when I think about a Supreme Court justice, you know, people dressed up as a Supreme Court justice at a Little League soccer game, is there a precedent for this kind of thing in history with Supreme Court justices?
Surely not. And what a great civics lesson that the girls on the soccer team who are wearing these costumes are then schooling the people around them about why they see this Supreme Court justice as a role model and how that is opening up possibilities for them, you know, expanding their horizons.
Mm. And, you know, in terms of the sort of what Erin mentioned about the sort of quiet leadership, that idea that she sort of kept her cool and that that was part of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's MO, is that also how you remember her?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was in some ways a quite shy and reserved person, and she had a very dignified, careful demeanor. There, she talked about how when she started doing oral arguments in the Supreme Court in the 1970s, you know, she was nervous like anyone would be. And then a couple of minutes in, she just forgot to be nervous. You know, she was so intent on making her points and, of course, so well prepared that that carried her through.
I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety. We're reflecting on the life and work of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg with legal writer Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and co-host of Slate's Political Gab Fest. And we want to hear from you. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg's leadership inspired you in any way or touched your life in some way, give us a call, 646-435-7280. Again, that's 646-435-7280. Or tweet us using the hashtag US of Anxiety. We'll be right back.
I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety. We're reflecting on the life and work of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a special two-hour edition of the show this week. In the next hour, we'll get to all the big questions about the court that Justice Ginsburg's death raises. But for now, we're pausing to think about and honor her contribution to history. I'm with legal writer Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, and our phones are open. For a lot of people, Justice Ginsburg meant a great deal more than your average Supreme Court justice. And let's go to Bill in Crown Heights. Bill, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, good to be here. How are you doing?
I'm well. How did Justice Ginsburg show up in your life?
Well, so I think it really has to do with the way women's equality indirectly impacted my life in a huge way. What her work, I should say specifically, had she not been such an influential figure for so many women and also in opening doors for women's equality, I wouldn't have had most of my mentors. My mentors through college, my first bosses, the ones who took me under their wings, overwhelmingly were women. And I may never have had all of those mentors who made me who I am today. And that's just, you know, working it backwards, yeah. I just even can't imagine.
Thank you for that, Bill. And it's an interesting point, right? That it's not just how something touches you directly, but how somebody's work then allows somebody else to touch you directly. It's a fascinating thing. Before I ask you to respond to that, Emily, let's go to Amy in Ringwood, New Jersey. I'm sorry. Amy, welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm an attorney in New York State. I came through and graduated in 1988. My father went to University of Chicago in 1955, and there was no women, none. A mentor of mine came through in 1956 at Fordham, and there was two women. I would not be here, right, unless it was Justice Bader Ginsburg. She was a trailblazer for female attorneys. My graduating class was 45% women in 1988 at Boston University. So it's something about the courage of the person taking the risks, right, knowing and having the confidence in herself and going forward with that confidence to achieve things that blaze the path for those of us that would follow.
Did that then shape the kind of work you do as an attorney or the kind of things you wanted to do in your life?
I am a litigator. Commercial litigation. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of like experiences with judges asking me what's for dinner, me changing what I was wearing when I first started to practice law, wearing dark colors, wearing glasses when I didn't necessarily need it, because you would get comments, you would get inappropriate just events happen to you, and you kind of knew there were people who did this before me. Like, I can't even imagine what she went through. A mentor of mine through Fordham in 56 said to me, when I came through, I had to wear pearls, wear black, and be quiet. And she, too, Kathleen Beckett, never got a job. Nobody would employ them, wow. In the 50s. They were an unknown commodity. And now I'm pleased to say, I think BU graduating class last year is more than 50% women. That's what you need, the opening, the people who go ahead and open the doors for us.
Thank you for that, Amy. Emily, I guess I want to think about when Amy talks about opening doors, and both Amy and Bill talk about opening doors, the actual legal doors that Justice Ginsburg opened, her most foundational contribution here as a legal activist was fighting to make the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause apply to gender. It initially only applied to race. Can you just sort of, in the best way, the best layman's terms you can, help us understand what that meant, what that change meant?
Yeah. So when Justice Ginsburg started litigating at the Supreme Court in the 1970s, there were laws on the books that just treated men differently than women for no good reason. So, for example, Idaho gave men preference over women in administering estates when somebody died. And the idea was that men knew more about the world of business. Justice Ginsburg challenged that law. She said, we got to have a higher standard here for treating people differently on the basis of gender. The next case involved a military regulation that denied husbands of women in the military some benefits that wives of men in the military received. And this was one of Justice Ginsburg's key moves. She would find men who were being discriminated against because they weren't fulfilling gender stereotypes. And then she would sue on their behalf in front of an all-male court, making the argument that men deserve the same benefits as women. And it was a way of showing that sometimes laws arise that are intended to protect women, and that actually they can be confining. They're not actually about being put on a pedestal. They're really about being put on a cage. And it was by making those arguments that Justice Ginsburg was able to achieve this standard from the court called heightened scrutiny. So the idea is, if you're going to have a law that treats people differently on the basis of gender, the court is going to be extra scrutinizing in looking in that law and seeing if it's constitutional, if it's valid. And a lot of laws got struck down because the justices were then saying, like, there's no good reason for this.
And it was really about, as you say, challenging this sort of paternalism that goes into, that went into so much of the discriminatory, the gender bias laws. And I guess I also want to ask you, did Justice Ginsburg ever talk about that paternalism, that sort of protecting women idea in the context of how race and gender come together in American politics, right? Because there's this long history of which, you know, that a lot of the logic of the lie of white supremacy in that era was also that, well, you know, you had to protect white women from black men. And I just wonder about the way the word we now would use is intersectional. I wonder how you would situate her work in that discussion about where race and gender come together on this idea of, like, paternal oversight of women.
Yeah. So here's the example that I'll give. I think that her idea of the importance of reproductive rights and freedom and access to abortion was very much informed by the issues you were just talking about. In this sense, she thought that to be free and equal, women had to be able to control the decision about when they were going to have a baby. And she was very aware that when you make it hard to get an abortion, the people who are really going to be burdened, who are going to really scramble, are poor women. And disproportionately in the United States, we see that African American and Latino women are seeking abortions. So she saw this intersection between race and class and gender. And that informed her deep and abiding concern for making sure that women had the freedom to make this decision.
It's interesting you bring up Roe. One of the things that I find interesting about her biography is we associate her so, or you bring up reproductive rights, is we associate her so much with the future of Roe, but that's not a decision that she was fully behind. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, and I think it actually fits with what we were just talking about. So her critique of Roe had two parts to it. The main part, which she really stuck to through her whole life, was that Roe should have been about the equal protection of women. It should have been about this constitutional right to gender equality. And it was not, because when Justice Blackmun and other men on the court signed on to Roe versus Wade in 1973, this is a 7-2 opinion, those men really framed this right in terms of the violation of privacy, and primarily they were concerned about the doctor's privacy and right to practice medicine. Mm. They included women, they included patients, but that was the sort of peg that they hung the right to abortion on. And Justice Ginsburg thought that was a mistake. She thought it would be much stronger to have a basis in the law that centered this question of gender equality that we're talking about. Her other concern, and I think there's some question about whether she was correct about this, but I'll tell you about it. Her other concern was that in 1973, there were states that were increasingly beginning to legalize abortion on their own. And she thought they should have more time to go through that process before the Supreme Court stepped in and effectively nationalized this right.
This is United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and we're reflecting on the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm speaking with New York Times Magazine writer Emily Bazelon, and we're taking your calls. One person we asked to call us is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired U.S. District Court judge who is a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School. And she wrote it in the Washington Post this Saturday, I guess just yesterday, about seeing Justice Ginsburg talk in the 1970s and how that shaped her. Nancy, thanks for hopping on the phone with us for a moment.
Thank you. This is great.
And so can you tell us, so you talked about, you wrote about hearing her talk. What was it that Justice Ginsburg was talking about that stood out to you?
She was talking about the Women's Rights Project of the ACLU, of which she was a founder. So she was really laying out a law reform agenda for women's rights, for reproductive rights, how to use the courts to affect social change. And I was, as I said in this piece, absolutely mesmerized. You know, I don't know whether anyone else has had the situation in which you see someone older than you, you look at them and you say, gee, I want to be you. And that's what that was my experience. And in fact, it shaped many of the choices that I made. I was already on the path to do civil rights law, criminal defense law, but that was enormously motivating to me as well.
Mm. You also wrote in a Boston Globe piece that Justice Ginsburg, quote, approached the law as, quote, a crass person who cared about the court's precedents and was going to work within them. What do you mean by crass person? For those of us who are not lawyers.
People described her as, you know, one of the court's liberals. And I imagine that part of the right-wing critique was that she was somehow an activist. Activist label in actuality was not true, and liberal is a relative term relative to where the rest of the court was. What she did is she cared deeply about precedent, and she cared deeply about precedent. She cared about her, you know, not creating major divisions with her colleagues. She cared about not dissenting too much because she thought that it undermined the moral authority of the court. And what that meant was that she would take the court's precedents and consider it and give it legitimacy and focus on it, but also put it in context. You know, the court's precedents, after all, about women had been a product of an earlier age with different assumptions about women. And so she would say, well, here was what the law says, but let's put it in the context of today. How should it be applied today? And there were, Linda Greenhouse talks about her, you know, decisions that were, quote, pure Ginsburg, which is, here's what the precedent is. Let me tell you, though, about how that has actually functioned in society. And there would be long discourses about the role in which generalizations about women, about assumptions about what women could or couldn't do, essentially skewed the application of the Constitution, skewed the application of the law. So she was upholding the precedent and applying it to a new set of facts, and she was happy to describe what those facts are, which she did over and over. Again, she did the same thing with respect to racial issues. You know, we cannot ignore a history of law-enforced discrimination against people of color. And what does that mean for today? She was not jettisoning precedent. She was applying it to the present. And, you know, there were her reticence to dissent was because she really thought that that wasn't good for the court. So her decisions were tight and careful, not screeds. and this was part of who she was.
Well, thank you for that, Nancy. I want to get to this question of her dissent, because she became famous for her dissent. So we will turn to that in a moment. But Nancy Gertner is the editor of Representative and Dissenting Opinions of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which will be published in December. And as I said, she wrote in the Washington Post this weekend about being mesmerized by Justice Ginsburg as a young lawyer in the 70s. So thanks for sharing that, Nancy. Let's go to Paula Whitney in Crown Heights. Paula Whitney, welcome to WNYC.
Good evening, Kai. How are you?
Very well. How did Justice Ginsburg inspire you?
In an enormous way. I am a proud gay transgendered person, but I squelched my transgendered my transgender identity for 50 years. It was a recent Bostock decision upholding the employment discrimination rights of LGBTQI people that emboldened me to write to my boss and insist that she stop calling me Paula, but now she calls me Paula Whitney. It was with the strength of that decision that I was able to take such a risk in writing to my boss, but she has since complied.
Mm. And it, so that decision, you heard that decision, you were like, that's it. This is it. I'm going to step
it,
out at
boy.
This point.
That's it.
That's wonderful. This is how law shows up in folks' lives. Emily, quickly, before we go to a break, do you want to respond to either what Paula Whitney said or what Nancy told us?
Well, I think that the Bostock opinion that Paula Whitney was pointing to is a culmination of Justice Ginsburg's concern that people not be stereotyped and put into boxes. And she was very much part of a majority decision granting full protection from being fired on the basis of being LGBTQ. And it's really an important part of her legacy. I have to tell you that Nancy Gertner, who is just was a formidable district court judge, very much someone in the model of Justice Ginsburg, was also my teacher when I was in law school.
Oh, no, I wish I had known this before I hung up.
but I have to tell you the story, which is that I took a sentencing seminar that Judge Gertner co-taught. And I took that seminar my last semester of law school, and I had just had a baby, really like a week before class started. And I was super nervous about whether I would still be taken seriously as a student and honestly as like a person in the world. And Judge Gertner was so lovely. She will still, when she sees me, ask how my son, who's now 20, is doing. And she remembers how she helped keep him quiet in class because I brought him to class. He had really just been born. She would take her charm bracelet and kind of dangle it in front of her to sort of calm him. And it was really, you know, it's a story I hope you can see about women helping women, very much in the model of Justice Ginsburg.
Well, this is the second story this hour of something that started with Justice Ginsburg and echoed down through several different people to arrive at a point of inspiration. So that that alone is inspiring to me. And Emily, before I let you go, I have to ask you this question of, why do you think that Justice Ginsburg did not retire during the Obama years? Or honestly, feel free to tell me that's a crappy question to ask.
No, funny. I'm trying to write a piece about that right now. I think it's a totally, a completely necessary and fair question to ask, actually. I think there are a number of steps to the answer. So in 2008, you know, when Obama was first elected, he pretty quickly got a chance to nominate Justice Sonia Sotomayor in 2009, and then the following year, Elena Kagan. And I think at that point, Justice Ginsburg, you know, first of all, she was in good health. She was at the full command of her powers. And I think she wanted to be part of helping settle in these new women to the court. You know, this idea that we started talking about having more women in the court and being part of that was really important to her. Then I think you see later on a kind of missed opportunity where she could have chosen to retire when Obama was in office and the Democrats controlled the Senate, but she loved her work. She was someone who was very committed to doing her work. And I think it was just very hard to let go at this moment where she felt so capable. Also, her husband died in 2010, and that they were very close. He'd been incredibly supportive of her, but that also meant that she had more time to work. It really filled her life. That's what I was hearing from people who clerked from her during that period. And then once you hit 2014, she started saying, you won't be able to confirm someone like me. And you can see that as like a mistake and an excuse, but when Obama's nominee Merrick Garland was blocked by Republicans in the Senate, you know, it turned out that Justice Ginsburg was right about that. Now, she had let a lot of time pass. There were years before that, but I think then that became a part of the story.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we can all have empathy for the idea that if, you know, you're doing something you love and it keeps you alive in some ways.
So. Yes. Yes. So the stakes are really high in this case.
Yeah. Emily Bazelon is a legal writer for the New York Times Magazine, host of Slate's Political Gabfest, among many other wonderful achievements. Thank you so much for joining us, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
And before we end this hour, many of us here in New York, we have watched many a Supreme Court drama play out from the front row seat that Brian Lehrer has provided us for almost three decades. Brian hosts a daily two-hour conversation here at WNYC every single weekday morning. And he's joining us now as a journalist, but also as a New Yorker who came out of a very similar cultural milieu as Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Brian, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Kai. Great show. Great to be with you.
So Justice Ginsburg died on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, and some who gathered on the Supreme Court steps Friday night, they said Kaddish for her. How important were her Jewish roots to who she became and the judge we came to know?
I think they were very important, and she talked about it. You know, I very much recognize Ruth Bader Ginsburg from my own New York Jewish background, as you were indicating. She grew up in Flatbush around the time as my parents, same time as my parents were growing up in the South Bronx. In fact, her maternal grandmother emigrated from the same city in what is now Ukraine that my maternal grandmother did.
Oh, wow.
I assume that hers, like mine, had the Ellis Island experience, and her mother, like my grandfather, worked their immigrant adult lives in the garment district and then took the subway home to an outer borough. And in that context, like my parents in the South Bronx, she grew up at the intersection of tough streets and an imperative to get educated. You know, my parents were first generation in their families to go to college, and so was Ginsburg and hers. And in that context, I want to play a clip of a speech that Ginsburg gave in Israel just 2 years ago, 2018. This is just a 40-second clip, but I think it exemplifies the kind of New York Jewish liberal mindset, if you will, that she came from, the kind of progressive, spiritual, intellectual that she was, and that that community, my community, has produced many of. Here she is.
I am a judge, born, raised, and proud of being a Jew. The demand for justice, for peace, for enlightenment runs through the entirety of the Jewish history and Jewish tradition. I hope that in all the years I have the good fortune to continue serving on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States, I will have the strength and courage to remain steadfast in service of that demand.
So Ginsburg in Israel in 2018, and of course politics among Jews, as among people of any religion, is diverse. There was the liberal Brooklyn Jewish culture that she came from. And of course, there are conservative Orthodox Jewish cultures in Brooklyn, too. But her origin story is a very New York liberal Jewish working class story.
Well, and as part of that origin story, too, is thinking about sort of this striving for education. Her mother, again, something I learned this in these past couple of days, had graduated from high school at 15, I think it was, and put aside a secret college fund for Ruth to go to college. Tell us about that striving for education within it all.
It's certainly true. It was how a lot of people did and do see their path to success after being immigrants to the United States. I think that's not unique to Jews or New Yorkers. You know, part of the story, as I understand it, of her mother is that as smart as she was, she didn't get to go to college because not everything about that tradition was progressive in those days. Her brother got the right to go to college, and the other kids in the family had to work to support the brother. The eldest male was the tradition who got to go to college. And Ginsburg's mother didn't. That's how I understand that story. Mm-hmm. But as you indicate, the striving was there, the desire was there, and it's incredible to think of how people were blocked at that time.
Thinking about that history too, you know, you point out this sort of rich history of liberal Jewish New York. I guess how would you compare that to today? Is this something to look at gauzily in the you know, way back in history there was this community that Justice Ginsburg came out of, or where would you put that in the community today?
I don't think it's something to look back gauzily at. I think if you look at, you know, the simple fact of voting patterns, American Jews, even though they're overwhelmingly white, vote for Democrats for president, and pretty much the rest of white America does not. So there's that.
That's not opinion. That's fact. The majority of white voters have not voted for a Democrat. Majority of white voters have not voted for a Democrat, and I forget how many cycles it is now.
But that's right. But Jews, overwhelmingly white in this country, are still voting 2-1, 65-70% for Democratic presidents, and it held through both terms of Obama, African-American president, and it held in 2016, and I expect it'll hold in 2020.
Brian, I want to sneak in one call with you on the line here, because Linda in Bridgeport, Connecticut, sounds like she's got an interesting New York story about this.
Great.
Hi, Linda. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi.
How are you? I understand that that you have a story about Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Brooklyn.
It's, well, not so much in Brooklyn, but I did grow up in another part of Brooklyn, also part of Flatbush. But she was, when I was about 6 years old, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was my junior counselor in camp. And
wait,
her nickname
did you go to,
was Kiki.
Did you go to Shinawa?
I did.
I was a counselor at Balfour down the street. But anyway,
oh, you're
ahead.
Kidding. That is funny. Balfour was across the lake. Her nickname was Kiki, and she Kiki Bader, and she was bouncy brown hair, very cute and pretty. And you could see even at around 17 years old that she had a capacity for leadership. Everybody loved her. And she was just, you know, out there leading people and doing things with an incredible amount of joy. You know, her tenacity was there then, and, you know, we saw it throughout the rest of her life. And there was a point when she was being grilled about becoming the justice, and I had no idea. And one of my old friends from my bunk in camp called me up and said, "What do you think is going on with Kiki Bader?" And I said, "I don't know what's going on with Kiki Bader." And I won't use the word she used, but basically she said, "Idiot, Kiki Bader is Ruth Bader Ginsburg." So from that point on, I really watched her career incredibly closely. My daughter is an attorney. I'm a psychotherapist, and the focus in our household about ethics and doing the right thing comes from that same background that she came from. And the fact that we've lost her during this time, which we call the 10 days of awe, when we look to ourselves and learn to kind of stretch to become a little bit better each year, it's just so much of who she was. And so this is a very moving time for me.
Mm. Linda, I wonder, Brian was talking about sort of this very specific era of liberal Jews in New York that that Kiki Bader came out of. Do you have a relationship to that as well?
Yeah, there was a liberal party in New York City. My grandfather was a member of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and he had come from the Ukraine as well. And my mother also didn't go to college because the brothers went to college, so that's very similar. There was an ethic and a sense of a belief in doing the right thing for the larger number of people that we just grew up with and we're very clear about. And the camp we went to was a Jewish camp, and we had services on both Friday night and Saturday morning at summer camp. So there is, I think, a level of ethical perspective that comes from that background that is pivotal for me, and I think very important to a great number of Jews.
Thank you for calling, Linda. Brian, closing thought on that ethical perspective that comes from that background.
Well, that ethical perspective, I think, if you're following it in a certain way, leads you to think about others. I tend to think of the liberal tradition. Maybe this is going to be ungenerous to conservatives, but I tend to think of the liberal tradition as looking outside of yourself, not just at your own interests. And that's where that comes from. And there are other traditions too. If you have time, I'll give you an observation about her as a New Yorker, not just the New York Jew and the Supreme Court, but I don't know how much time you have
60 seconds,
left.
Do it.
All right. You know, when Ginsburg and Scalia were both alive, there was a certain diversity on the Supreme Court that was probably never achieved before. Ginsburg was from Brooklyn. Scalia was from Queens. There was Justice Kagan from Manhattan and Justice Sotomayor from the Bronx. So to achieve true diversity, they would have had to have a justice from Staten Island and complete the set, although Justice Scalia represented Staten Island values pretty well based on how Republican the borough votes.
Okay. Brian Lehrer will be talking over these things, I am sure, tomorrow morning and every morning this week, probably. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
You bet.
This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and we have had a special edition of the show going this week. We're talking about the life and legacy of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We'll be back in the next hour to talk about the future of the court. Stay with us. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Mirando were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Froman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. That's K-A-I. And write like the brothers. And if you can, join us each week, Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern, for the live version of our show. Stream it on WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.